Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. This is episode number 37. My name is Karen, and I am joined by Kristen.
Sup? I'm sort of awake. It's Friday.
Yeah,
We're recording on a Friday.
I've been up since 8, which is not that early for people who have, like, normal jobs and don't get to sleep in and work from home and stuff like that. But, like, I've been wrangling cats, well, one cat, and just running around the place everywhere. So I feel like I'm exceptionally frantic right now. But, you know, what's new? We're always under a lot of stress.
Like, if we're not running around doing 78 things, trust me, there's at least 3 things that I was supposed to get done this week, and they're not done.
Yeah.
And my brain is mad at me, and I'm like, listen, I really needed to do the things I did, okay? I needed to do those first.
Yeah.
So now I just have to make my peace and get done as much as I can.
Samesies. Mm-hmm. If you would like to contact us, you can do so at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, and Facebook, and Prophecy Radio Podcast at gmail.com. We are going to be talking about the casting, finally. I feel like it's been 300 years since it's only been like 2 weeks, but
yeah,
we couldn't get to it until now, but I'm excited to talk about casting and these awesome people who have joined the Percy Jackson and the Olympians television show. Before we get to that, though, we're going to jump into news as usual. So Rick actually put up another blog post. So we technically have the casting blog post to go through, but we're not going to read the whole thing. And then we have this June 12th blog post that I'm going to go through first.
An embarrassment of riches.
I know, right? Yeah, that might have to be the episode title. Not going to lie, that's pretty good. I like that. Okay, so basically he starts off the June 12th blog post by thanking everyone helping them produce such a complicated show. And I just love how, like, open and grateful he is about not knowing a whole lot about the process and, like, learning new stuff every day and realizing how much it takes to put a television show like this together. I think people who aren't as familiar with that process, like, hearing that, I think hopefully will make them have more appreciation for TV and movies and, you know, yeah, production in general. He also writes, what's an average day like for executive producers Rick and Becky Riordan? We commute to the studio each morning or to location if we're filming somewhere outside. After COVID testing every other day, we go to the set where we can have a producer's tent off to one side of the stage. There, our chairs await along with a big monitor and headphones so we can watch the shots as they happen. In the last 7 days, we've cycled through 3 different sets and we'll be heading to a different one tomorrow. This is so the construction team can be prepping one set while we're using another. Then we can switch stages and let the crew change up the first one, etc., to make the best use of our time. So, first and foremost, COVID testing every other day. I mean, I feel like that's intense but good because there's so many people involved.
Yeah, I think industry standards for that now, it's become fairly regular.
Yeah.
Like, especially if your show, I mean, which one wouldn't, involved you being, like, in close proximity to people.
Right.
Like, if for some reason, you know, like, it's a game show or something and you can have 6 feet between people, I don't think they are quite as, like, you know, worried. But for any sort of scripted programming where people have to act like it's not, you know, still a pandemic, I think it's become pretty regular that you test every day or you test every other day. So I, you know, it's nice to know that they're still being cautious of it.
Yeah, definitely. And we want to keep everybody safe and make sure that, you know, production isn't halted because everybody gets COVID. I mean, that would be a tragedy considering we're already going to filming till January. So
yeah,
we don't want any delays. Please, please, please. So the other big thing in this paragraph, I think, is the fact that in 7 days, or maybe like 8 days, really, they'll have done 4 different sets.
Yeah.
I feel like that's a lot, right? Like, that's huge.
We don't have any idea what, I mean, they're obviously shooting, like, the first episode.
Yeah.
So they've probably got a lot of smaller sets that will change or whatever. So you've probably got, like, Percy's bedroom or, like, the apartment mm-hmm. set. And then you've also got maybe a generic, you know, school set for right. stuff at Yancey, I believe. Yeah, Yancey, I think.
Was Yancey the first one?
I forget. Anyway. Yeah. The school. Whatever the school is. And, you know, and, like, maybe they've got some trees set up for, like, some outdoor shots or the car for the car stuff. And, like, I'm trying to think of all the things that they could be shooting. Plus, they can be shooting completely out of order, so it might be stuff from the finale of the show that they're getting done now while they're yeah. waiting to go on location or waiting to, you know. So I'm, like, it's kind of killing me trying to guess, like, what sets are these? Like, yeah. what could they be working on right now? So, yeah, it's kind of a lot, but, like, TV shows, once they establish a set like that, they do scroll, you know, they change between them depending on the episode, like,
right.
rapid fire, you know? Yeah. Like, they get all the shots done in one set that they can, and then they move on to another one, and then they'll go back if they need it or whatever, so... Yeah, it's crazy, but fun.
Yeah. Rick has said that June and July will be pretty much for filming episodes 1 and 2. I mean, there's a chance they could do some stuff out of order, like you said, if it's just more convenient. But I think the likelihood, especially because you're right, the first couple episodes are going to be like at the apartment, at school, at the museum, maybe out in the woods with, mm-hmm. like, the Minotaur stuff, and then, like, basically getting to camp.
Yeah.
So that's very early on in the show, so...
Yeah. So, like, I would imagine they're probably not at Camp Half-Blood yet, like, shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Although we did see that tweet from Rick...
Right.
...yesterday yeah. with the trees. So, like, that makes me think that they've chosen that location, and, like, maybe they're checking on it or building stuff. Maybe he wasn't there to shoot yet, but he was there to, mm-hmm. like... see how things were going and right. just get an idea. Like, yeah, because who knows? They might have already started that. I mean,
yeah,
you never know.
We really don't have that much of an idea, but I think it's pretty spectacular that they're already going through 4 sets. I actually really like this because, yes, it's probably a lot more money and a lot more work, but not like... condensing what we see from the books for the show is going to be really cool because it's going to make the world feel so much more real and tangible, and, like, obviously I'm all for that.
Mm-hmm.
He goes on to say, a lot of my day then is sitting in a dark tent with the other producers, watching the shots happen and giving feedback when needed, which honestly isn't very often. The raw footage is amazing, even before any editing. While watching the filming, I'll have my laptop open to work on script revisions or check updates to the schedule or look at casting tapes for upcoming roles later in the season. Occasionally, I'll even be able to do some writing on my next book. Remember back when I was just a novelist? Ah, the simpler times. And again, like, a lot of really just tiny, cool stuff here. Like, first of all, he loves the raw footage. He's not giving a whole lot of feedback, which I think is a very good thing, because if Rick's happy, I think we're going to be happy.
Agreed.
Script revisions probably has to do with both the TV show and the Kane Chronicles movies, so that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And casting tapes for upcoming roles later in the season, so they're still casting people, which is cool. Hopefully we get that stuff soon.
Yeah, I was gonna say, and it makes sense, like, so, you know, maybe they haven't cast Ares yet because he doesn't show up until,
right,
you know, a couple of episodes down the road here, stuff like that. Yeah. They focused on getting the ones they needed for episodes 1, 2, 3, you know. Mm-hmm.
And even, like, the other gods, like, don't yeah. really show up till the end if they're going to cast them now. So yeah. that's pretty cool. And then, of course, I'll even be able to do some writing on my next book, which we think is the Irish mythology book.
Okay.
Because I think if it was Salangelo, he would have said Salangelo. And they're pretty much done with that anyway.
I was going to say, do recall, they're basically done with the initial drafts of that.
Yeah.
They're just kind of, you know, doing going through, fixes. And
yeah, like stuff line like checks for, like, so, grammar yeah, and stuff.
It probably is new mythology.
Yeah, which is pretty cool. I can't imagine it's all that easy to write on a set like that. So good for him if he's able to do that.
I will say the one thing, I mean, I'm not an actor, so I can't tell you that for definitively. But the one thing I've heard from actors is that it's a lot of hurry up and wait is the going yeah. phrase, the joke. Is like, you hurry, you hurry, you hurry, you have to be on set, they want you there. But then something goes wrong, they're fixing lights, they're changing, you know, the way the camera's set up, or they have to fix this because this issue comes up. And so the actors end up sitting on set waiting for the moment. And as soon as it's like, okay, now we're ready, here, get on set. Like, they have to be there in a minute.
Yeah.
Like, you know, so they're sitting around in makeup, ready to go a lot of the day. So I'm wondering if that's kind of, like, with Rick, like, since he's a producer and he's not the only producer, he's on set, he's there to answer questions or help or, you know, do anything that he can do. But other than that, like, he's kind of just watching shots, and in between shots, he's working on his book and writing stuff. Like, I wonder if that's maybe good for him to, like, be able to... Sometimes your brain functions better if you're moving from one activity to the next.
Yeah.
Like, not focusing on one thing for too long allows your brain to kind of rest on that
idea. On the other thing, yeah.
And then things come to you. So, like, who knows? Maybe he'll end up liking this, you know, form of writing. Like,
yeah.
Gives him a chance to kind of take a break and sit with an idea. And, you know, we'll see. We'll see how he ends up liking it in the end when whatever book he's writing is done.
Yeah.
But... I think it could be useful.
The writer's room is still working on tweaking past episodes and writing future ones, which we kind of expected. He also writes, other times Becky and I will join in pre-viz meetings to look at storyboards for future episodes. These are like really slick PowerPoint presentations which combine comic book style sketches with rough 3D animations to show each scene shot by shot, line by line, so the designers, camera operators, prop masters, and stunt coordinators can all figure out how to bring those scenes to life. If there is a scene with monsters and cars, for instance, they may also have toy models on the conference table. It's pretty fun to see grown adults playing with toys. And then he can be like, bam, and the car goes screech, and then, ah!
Love
I
it.
I thought that was really funny.
This is why movie and TV making makes me so happy.
Because yeah.
It's literally, like, adults drawing and adults playing with toys and adults, like, making believe and using their imaginations, and it's not a thing you get really unless you're in a creative art like this.
Yeah.
I did want to point out, like, I don't know how familiar our listeners are with animation and, like, the whole process of animation, especially if you're a little younger. Maybe it's just not something you've had experience with yet. If you ever, like, on your Disney movies, like, if you have a Blu-ray or a DVD, the extras on those almost always have, like, deleted songs or deleted scenes, and sometimes when you play them, it's not full animation.
Right.
It's, like, sketchy.
It's, like, the models,
you can
yeah.
see, yeah, and so that's what he's talking about with the previs, is, like, this is kind of how they set things up, and I was gonna say, if you really want to, like, look at how animation previs goes, there's a Making of Frozen 2 doc that I've watched, like, a million times.
I think we've talked about it before,
yeah.
too, because it's
and, like,
so good.
And they do a really good job of kind of doing some of this previs work where they were trying to figure out a song and they go through and, like, you can see the different steps of the animation and, like, they're storyboarding things and you can kind of, yeah. So if you're ever curious about how this previs thing works, kind of check your Disney extras, because that's a really good representation of, like, how the whole process works. But also, yeah, that documentary is really good.
It is. It's so, so good.
But yeah, this is, it's good fun to hear that they're kind of in on all that, too, because that's where the big stuff, like, storyboarding and previs stuff is where you work out all the kinks of the story.
Yeah, you make a lot of decisions.
Yeah, you're trying to, you know, solve problems before they are a problem, and that's just, yeah, it's nice to know they're in on all that stuff, too.
Yeah.
I mean, we knew they were, but it's nice to hear.
I still like hearing about it. So the last little thing is just a super fun thing. Have you seen any of the helpful lingo that Rick put up on his site? Or do you know any of these?
I have not. I need to spend more time on his site. What is wrong with me?
That's okay. I like reading it to you and getting your fresh take on things. So
okay.
that wasn't a call out. That was just like, I have not heard of any of these before.
I do
but
not feel called out.
Okay, good, good. I have not heard of any of these before, so I... But you know more than I do, so I didn't know if you did. Okay, so maybe... Can I quiz you?
I'll try.
Okay, so...
I don't know, now I'm nervous.
Okay. He writes, there's a lot of sitting around, and he said, over the last week, I've learned some helpful lingo, which you may find useful if you ever find yourself on a film set. So the first one is the martini. Do you know what that means?
No.
If somebody says, like, it's the martini, or something.
This with probably, no context.
With no context.
With no context, my guess is that it's some sort of, like, coffee beverage bar thing or something. That would be my guess.
Yeah, I that makes more sense than what it actually is, but the explanation is interesting. So a martini is the last shot of the day is called the martini, supposedly because film people drank a lot back in the day.
That makes so much sense.
Yeah, and when the director yelled martini, everybody rejoiced because they knew the next shot would be from a martini glass at their favorite bar. So next time you're walking by an active film set, be sure to yell martini and watch the entire crew start to cheer and pack up to go home. Actually, don't do that. It would be mean.
No, I've never heard that. That's cool.
Okay. So, all right. So this is related to that. So maybe this will help.
Okay.
What's the Abbey shot?
My guess would be that it refers to, like, the Sound of Music Abbey, like, because that's such an iconic film, but I have no idea.
No. Also a very good guess, and I think a logical one. Okay, this is what he says. I haven't actually heard this one used yet, but the Abbey shot is the second to last shot of the day. It was named after a guy named Abbey Singer, who used to tell the crew, this is the martini, and then change his mind afterwards and say, oops, no, actually, we have one more. So the Abbey shot became sort of the fake martini that gets your hopes up, then crushes them. In case you're wondering, the third to last shot of the day is called the third to the last shot of the day.
That's fun. That actually just kind of cracks me up because I've seen, like in the extras for Lord of the Rings, mm-hmm. when they were trying to, like, end principal shooting.
Yeah.
Like, Peter Jackson was like, okay, let's do one more. Like, I think it was, like, a shot with, like, Frodo and Sam or something. He'd be like, let's do one more. Quick, don't lose focus. Like, let's stay in. Let's do one more. And, like, they'd do one more. And then they'd do one more. And afterward, Peter Jackson was like, we got it, like, 15 takes ago. I don't know why I kept going. I don't think I wanted it to end. I wasn't ready for it to end. So I just kept telling him to do it again. But I'm pretty sure the one they did, like, an hour ago was the one we're going to use. And so it kind of cracks me up
to,
like, think of it that way. Like, the actors think this is the last one. We'll do one more take. We'll do one more take. Like, it's just really funny.
Okay, so if somebody comes up to you and says either 10-1 or 10-2, do you know what that means?
I know what 10-4 means.
Yeah.
10-1 or 10-2? Jeez, I don't know any of these. No, I don't.
I've never heard of them either. So, okay, so 10-1. If you need to pee while you're on set, you don't yell, I need to pee. That's much too easy. Instead, you yell 10-1 and everybody knows you have gone to pee. BRB. Try it next time you need to leave class. Teacher, 10-1, I'm out. I'm sure that'll work out fine.
See, that makes sense. It's radio etiquette so that you're not yelling things on the radio that are untoward.
Sensitive.
Like, when I used to work at an outdoor job where I was kind of by myself at a merchandise cart all day, we had different codes for it. So ours was, like, code blue, code green.
Oh.
So, like, if we were having money problems, like, we needed change or something, we'd call code green and somebody would come and switch it out.
Yeah.
Code blue is if you had to pee, somebody would come and let you.
Which is weird, because isn't it code blue in a hospital, like, somebody stopped breathing?
Yeah. For us, that meant, like,
I need to pee. Really, yeah. That's
but,
funny.
Like, yeah, so that makes sense. Like, a 10-1, 10-2, they would be different emergency codes.
Yeah, so you know what 10-2 means, then.
Okay.
If 10-1 is peeing.
Then the other. Okay.
Yeah.
I was going to say.
10-2, can you guess? Yes, that's if you need to poop. Rick Riordan writing about...
Why did you be specific? How about 10...
I just have to go to the bathroom.
I don't know.
Well, I guess, like, that's if you need to poop, so you may be gone a little longer than for a 10-1. This is why I came to Hollywood, folks, to learn the glamorous secrets of stage and screen. It's also good to know that in trucker lingo, that's a big 10-4, good buddy, is absolutely not the same as that's a big 10-2, good buddy. You have been warned.
Thank you, Rick.
Yeah.
I'm enjoying this application.
Oh, me too. This is great. Okay, so we have one more. Also, just Rick Riordan talking about poop on his blog. I mean, never thought I'd see the day.
The pinnacle of art.
Right? All right, last one is the circus. And I will give you a clue. This is like an area on set. What would the circus be?
Instinct would tell me it's like the backstage area just off set where sets are constantly being moved through in big pieces for the set, like furniture and whatever, because it's like a three-ring circus, like mm-hmm. getting things in and out of set all the time. That would be my instinct.
Again, very logical, but wrong.
It's okay. I don't mind being wrong.
This is the area on the lot where all the trailers are set up for makeup, hair, costumes, restrooms, and the actors' prep rooms. I suppose this is because it looks like the circus caravan is in town, but as far as I can tell, there are no elephants, giraffes, sword swallowers, or cotton candy in this circus. I have looked.
Well, they also... In circuses, isn't it, like, center ring? So if, like, if they're all kind of... Depends on how they position them.
Right.
But if they're kind of positioned like a ring, it would make sense that that would be a circus, too. But that is... That's
right?
Fun.
Isn't that fun?
Yeah.
I actually really liked that.
Here I was thinking he was about to get artsy-fartsy on us. Like, film terms like mise-en-scene and all this other stuff. I was like, oh, I know this No, I don't know anything. What are you talking about?
Well, now you know how to tell people you've pooped, so.
I mean, yeah.
What else do you need to know?
For everything.
Yeah.
I never would have thought that you had to be specific on it.
I know, right?
I don't want people to know when I'm pooping, but, like...
I guess if you're the director and you're, like, gone for a while and people start to worry or something, like, oh, well, yeah, he's just pooping.
If you're an actor they're waiting on, like, yeah. You tell them, like...
That would be the worst, like...
I've got a 10-2 sitch, I gotta go.
Yeah.
And you, like... Run.
Then everybody knows that you just had to poop. Like, God.
There are no secrets on a film set.
Yeah, I guess not.
It's one of those things that I think we don't really take... Like, we don't really think about it, but actors are kind of used to people being in their bubble. And like,
yeah.
They're used to people helping them get dressed and helping them do, you know. So it's a lot less, like...
Yeah.
Weird for someone to see you, you know.
They have less shame than I do, I think.
Yeah, that's a very good way of putting it, yeah. So I think that might be part of it is like, listen, I have a 10-2 sitch, so if you wanted to change that camera angle, go for it, because I need time. Like,
yeah.
It makes logical sense why they might need to know that, but I don't want to tell people I'm pooping.
That is very true. Okay, let's move on from poop.
It was fun, but we're done now.
Okay, so The Last Fallen Moon by Gracie Kim is out in the world.
Woo-hoo!
Yay! We're very excited. Last week, we talked about The Last Fallen Star, and we interviewed Gracie Kim. So if you haven't listened to that yet, please go do so. She was super sweet and very, very nice, and we love her a lot.
It was so much fun talking to her,
It too. Was. It really was. And her book is being translated into Turkish, Polish, and Italian, which is very exciting. It's going global. She was very excited about that.
Heck yeah.
If you guys end up reading The Last Fallen Moon or even The Last Fallen Star, let us know what you thought about it and if you have any, you know, general thoughts on it.
Mm-hmm.
As Kristen said before, we got a 6-second clip of some treetops, and I guess Becky actually took this video and Rick posted it to his socials, and really it's just some trees and a very gray sky, and you can hear some birds singing in the background.
But a little wind, maybe.
Yeah, but like, I still got so excited.
I know.
I was like, that's camp. Like, that's what you would see when you're at camp and you look up into the trees.
Yeah.
And that just made me so happy. And it just felt more tangible,
like,
you know?
Is he at the gate?
Yeah.
Is he on the... Capture the flag, like,
right
course?
Out in
or
the forest,
or is he like in the main camp area? Like, your brain starts to run through all the places he could be. Is this by the big house? Like,
yeah,
where is he right now?
There's also some very solid speculation about other cast members, people who have been seen with the trio, which again, we said doesn't necessarily mean that they're cast in the show, because a lot of other shows are filming in Vancouver right now, but some of them have followed like the entire cast and Rick and all this yeah. other stuff. So there's some possibilities. We're not going to talk about it because we just want to wait until it's final casting. We don't want to do like all the speculation stuff. So,
but it's out there. If you're interested, it's not hard to find.
Yeah. If you go to Updates Percy, they really stay on top of everything. So
yeah, I've noticed that too.
Yeah. Really, so really on Twitter, Updates Percy, if you want to see the speculation and all that jazz.
Because it's fun. It's okay.
Yeah. We also got an article from Reed Riordan about a list of queer characters from the books. However, it has been since taken down, which I actually kind of am glad, because there were some issues with using the proper pronouns, like for Alex Fierro, and some language wasn't super great and representation wasn't like what it should have been. And I think it was an honest mistake on whoever writes these. We don't actually know who writes the Reed Riordan articles. It's just somebody on that team. So it has been taken down. I don't know if it's going to be put back up again. I hope it is. I couldn't find it, so I'm assuming maybe they're just reworking it and maybe it'll go up again later or something. But it was there. I'm sure people have screenshots of it and stuff, but
I was going to say, I didn't see the actual article, but I did see, like, the screenshot of the characters in the different colors of the rainbow, which I thought was a cool feature. And I saw some talk about, like, Piper's characterization and, like, stuff like that being one of the ones that had some issues. So I'm glad, I'm glad that mistakes happen, and I'm glad that they're kind of looking at it if that's what's going on.
Yeah, and I do hope that it goes back up with the proper, you know, language and everything. So, there's that. Last thing I wanted to mention just kind of randomly was there was a Screen Rant article that the title is Moon Knight's Success is Great for Rick Riordan's King Chronicles series. And I just really like this because, of course, we want all of Rick's things to be super successful. And as I was watching Moon Knight, I was reminded of the way that, because in King Chronicles and Moon Knight, it's like you kind of, the spirit inhabits you. So it's kind of like a possession sort of deal. And I saw a lot of those similarities between the two properties. So I was already thinking about their connection, and then Becky tweeted about this article and I was like, cool, like other people are writing about this, and it just got me excited. So I'll link to that if you guys want to read it. There's not much to the article. It's basically just like, yeah, we think that it's gonna make it more successful because it'll Moon Knight exposed Egyptian mythology and a lot of those same principles to a general audience.
That was going to be my next question, because I have not yet watched Moon Knight,
and
I have not read King Chronicles. But what I do know, and I thought they had in common, was the whole Egyptian gods thing.
Yeah.
So I was going to say, like, it is pretty well respected these days that when something kind of takes our focus and we get into it, people kind of jump into other projects that are related to it or at all, related, whether through an actor or whatever. So I think it's really cool that we just got Moon Knight from Disney because it did kind of get people excited and interested in the Egyptian gods, and now you've got Rick Riordan's version of this that's going to be coming out on Netflix in the next couple of years. So, like, that's actually really cool because it kind of keeps that, the idea, you know, the Egyptian mythology kind of right there in the forefront. And yeah, I think that is.
And superheroes and family friendly projects, like, there's a lot of crossover between those two a lot of the time. So,
especially Marvel,
So I think, you know, younger kids and teens who watched Moon Knight and just want more, like, probably would have watched Kane Chronicles anyway, but, like, you know, it'll help get more people into it. So that's really cool.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay, we're going to try to stay on track. We're going to try to stay on time today. We're jumping to our main discussion. We're talking about casting. This is so exciting. This is actually a jump back in time to the June 2nd blog post from Rick. And I'm going to read, like, little clips of it, but honestly, it was mostly just him talking about the actors. There wasn't too much more. And then Small Bob at the end.
Small Bob.
Yeah, but I will link to that as always. So we're going to start off with Virginia Call as Sally Jackson. And what Rick said about her was, her combination of strength, humor, and heart makes her just the Sally Jackson we need. In the table read for episode 101, her performance moved us to tears. So already, you're just starting, you know, out of the gate on fire. So that is so exciting.
I definitely think Sally is the character that gives you the strongest emotional connection in Lightning Thief. Like, we're meeting Annabeth, we're meeting Chiron, we're meeting Luke. Like, we don't yet have super, super strong, Percy doesn't have super strong emotional ties to them yet. So the stuff connected to his mom is definitely where you get the real pull from. And, I'm honestly, as much as I wanted Melissa Bonzio,
I know,
because she's just perfect and I love her, I'm really, really excited about Virginia Call. I've seen her in a couple of things, especially as Emily Barnes in Big Little Lies. She's the teacher, like the first grade teacher to all the little kids, like all the main character little kids. And she does a really good job. Like, she's got very good teacher energy, which is just funny in general. But she did a really, really good job on Big Little Lies. I'm interested to see how that translates to Sally, but, like, she's a very talented girl. And I also wanted to know, I have not watched Grace Point, which is a limited series starring David Tennant, and it's, I believe, an adaptation of a British miniseries that I have watched, which is Broadchurch, which he was the star of. I'm pretty sure Grace Point is an American adaptation of Broadchurch. The reason I say this is because I'm pretty sure in Broadchurch, the mom's name is Beth, and Virginia Cole's character's name is Beth.
Oh.
What's the difference? Okay, they changed the ending a little bit, apparently, between Broadchurch and Grace Point.
Oh, okay.
But Grace Point is Broadchurch's American adaptation. But yeah, like, I just recognized the name Beth in relation to Grace Point, and I was like, oh, I've watched Broadchurch, and I keep meaning to watch Grace Point. So, yeah, I'm that does make me, like, she's good at playing a mother. Like, yeah. Beth is a very interesting mother character, because it's a murder mystery, so you're kind of, like, you know, along with this grieving mother and, like, all that. So, like, she's definitely, you know, she can handle the emotional stuff. I am really interested to watch this now and kind of see her as, like,
Yeah, because I think you made a good point a minute or two ago when you said that we kind of automatically have this emotional connection to Sally just because she's Percy's mom. But not only that, it's like we know she's in an abusive relationship with a guy who treats her terribly. We know she loves her son more than anybody else. Like, she is a very empathetic character. Like, you'd have to be pretty weird to not love Sally.
Yeah.
And so you're right. I think it's very easy to just have this instant emotional connection to her. So I'm also very excited about this.
Yeah. But I also have to say that I got really excited because she was apparently on one of my, like, all-time, I say favorite shows, but it's just, like, one of those that I feel the most passionately about. The Following, which is not for children.
Kristen and I, yeah, that's true. Kristen and I will yell about The Following to anyone who will listen. Like,
it's a show about serial killers, and it makes you feel bad for serial killers, and that's really good writing, if I do say so myself.
Yeah, that's true.
But she was on that. I don't remember her.
I looked her up and I think she was only on like two episodes or something, and I didn't really recognize her, but I was actually thinking about going back and rewatching The Following fairly recently, so I might have to keep an eye out for her.
But yeah, that just made me happy. Yeah. It's a good show, and it's, you know, it's a really well-written, crazy adventure that you go on with that show. And, you know, seeing her be involved, she's been in a million things, like so many actors are.
Yeah,
in, you know, one episode of different shows.
She's been in a lot of smaller TV roles, but that's also good because she's had experience on a lot of different kinds of sets. So she still brings, like, even if she hasn't had super major roles that everybody knows about, like, she's been around for a while, she knows what she's doing, and I think she's gonna bring that to Sally's character. And I think we talked about this last time too, she originally wanted to be a doctor and then decided to be an actor instead. So
I don't know if I knew that.
Yeah, I think we mentioned it on the last episode. Yeah,
my brain has forgotten.
I mean, that's still, it's difficult.
That's cool.
Okay, so jumping into Jason Mantzoukas now as Mr. D / Dionysus, the only fan cast.
The one we got right.
Yeah, the one we got right. Rick's comments are basically self-described as 100% Greek. Jason is the perfect guy to inhabit everyone's favorite grumpy wine god and head of camp, Dionysus. And I feel like it's kind of difficult to talk about Jason Mantzoukas because he has been in so much.
He's
like,
all over.
He is everywhere. And especially, he does a lot of voiceover stuff because his voice is so unique. And, like, that, I know him as Jay on Big Mouth. If you are old enough, you can go see what role he plays on Pam and Tommy. But I would not recommend it for anybody who's young. And, yeah, he just does a lot of voiceover work that I really enjoy. But, and, like, I've seen him on The Good Place too, but you've seen him in a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, he keeps appearing. He's a really, really skilled and great comedic actor, and he's made his, I would say, made his career by playing these problematic, loud, obnoxious characters.
Yeah.
So, like, I remember him as Adrian Pimento on Brooklyn Nine-Nine. That one a little less, because while I love Brooklyn Nine-Nine, I've watched it the least. but he also, yes, played Derek Hofstetler, Janet's boyfriend, on The Good Place. And then he also played Dennis Feinstein on Parks and Rec, which is probably the role I've seen him in the most, even though it's a fairly minor role. But Dennis Feinstein is, like, this business owner, like, entrepreneur that has, like, his own perfume line and is, like, a perfumist, which is a weird word. But, like, he actually has another name, but because Pawnee is where Pawnee is, he changed his name to Dennis Feinstein. It's so weird. Like, there's a whole explanation okay. for it in the show. It's ridiculous and it's fun. But, yeah, no, he's such a character in all of those roles.
Yeah.
Like, he just... He has this thing about him, and mm-hmm. he does it so well, and it's going to be perfect for Mr.
Yeah,
D.
Yeah, I think he's going to be literally just the perfect Dionysus. I know we had talked about some other people like Jack Black, and I think they would have been very good. Like, he would have been awesome, too. But there's just something about his voice and this, like, he's got this, like, dispassionate look behind his eyes where he just doesn't really care, and that is Dionysus. Like, he cares on the inside, but he very rarely shows it. And I think that his voice is going to be really good, and I can just hear him calling Percy Peter Johnson, and
yeah.
it's going to be so good. Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah. And I can also hear him, like, yelling.
Yeah. He's got a very loud voice.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
And I think he can be kind of intimidating too. Like, I don't know stature wise like how big of a guy he is, but he's just that crazy hair and his crazy eyes. Like, I just feel like he can be very imposing and intimidating when he wants
to. From what I remember, I want to say he's very tall, but he's not like really broad.
Yeah,
like, he's a narrow kind of guy, but I'm pretty sure he's rather tall. Mm-hmm. So that isn't what I necessarily pictured with Dionysus. For some
yeah.
reason, I've always pictured him shorter, kind of a little, you know,
bigger,
chubbier,
yeah.
whatever. But I'm definitely down for his portrayal. He's mm-hmm. going to be great.
He's
going to
be amazing.
I kind of added a note here. He's got sarcastic jerk face down to a science, which is so true.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that kind of fits right in with Mr. T.
Yeah, I mean, it's you really cannot get much better than him, if you can at all. So this
yeah.
is going to be great. The other fun fact I had was he's an accomplished jazz drummer. So
I mean, that's just cool.
That's fun,
right?
Why not?
We're just
yeah,
adding, yeah. Maybe they can get Mr. D playing some jazz drums
yeah.
in the background or something.
That would be really funny. Okay, so this next one is kind of a big one and something that I think we wanted to take a little more time talking about, because Megan Mullally as Mrs. Dodds / Electo is an interesting choice. Definitely one that we're totally cool with, like, no complaints here, but wasn't somebody that we necessarily imagined when we were fan casting the role. Rick didn't have any specific comments about her, basically just talked about all of the roles she's had, and I mean, she's been everywhere. She's, you know, Karen Walker on Will and Grace, and I know that she's Gail on Bob's Burgers, and I think she does some other voices too, and she was also randomly on an episode of Murder She Wrote, like, back in the day, so I thought that was fun.
I had fun scrolling back through her filmography
mm-hmm.
and, like, looking at all the single episode roles
yeah.
that she's had, because she has done a lot
mm-hmm.
of really great programming, and, like, so she's been around, and she's kind of, like, she's not an old actress, but, like, she's older, so she's been around, so when she was younger and a kid, she was able to do some of these programs that we feel like were shot like a million years ago, but they really weren't, and
yeah.
like Murder, She Wrote and some of those. So yeah, I had fun looking back to see all the little things that she's gotten to do. But I probably know her best as Tammy Swanson, Tammy 2, on Parks and Rec. Yeah, she's incredible and playing opposite her husband. So
right.
she, you know, has a good old time, and the two of them together is bonkers.
Yeah.
Like, they are absolutely insane. I have no idea if Nick Offerman is up for a role in Percy
man.
Jackson.
Yeah.
But he and they work together a lot
mm-hmm.
and they work together very well.
Yeah.
So if there's any sort of role in which Mrs. Dodds needs someone to kind of, like, you know, interact with, like,
yeah.
I would not be shocked if Nick ends up just popping up for a scene or something.
Like, it's funny because a lot of people were talking about, like, in some reality, Nick Offerman is Hades, so, like, they would interact
I mean,
a lot, you know?
It
wouldn't be bad. And I think even just as a guest role, like, I think it would be really cool to have him around. Because he's a great actor. He's very funny. I think he would fit the tone of Percy Jackson really well. Yeah,
Oh my gosh, with his mustache, he could be Pop Lopez.
He could.
I know that they don't, like, work, but he kind of is what I kind of picture. From, okay, yeah. Moving on.
When they were dating, he was on an episode of Will and Grace, and then in a different role was on another episode later after they were married. And yeah, they've worked together on other things. They also have their own podcast, In Bed with Nick and Megan, where they talk about their personal lives and, like, have interviews with other, you know, actors and people that they know. Because between the two of them, they know a lot of people. They've both been around for a while. So.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I think the interesting thing with her is that she's younger than I kind of imagined Mrs. Dodds would be, which is funny because, like, I mean, she's middle age slash I think she's 50s or 60s, you know.
I was gonna say somewhere in the 50s is what I imagine.
But she does have that, like, grating voice. I mean, it's what she's known for as Karen on Will and Grace, so that's not saying anything that people don't already know.
She definitely plays into her voice.
Yeah.
She's not ashamed of
it. For sure. And I think she has that, like, I can picture her as this math teacher that nobody likes, that everybody hates going to her classroom. And I think that it's a good casting choice. Like, I'm actually really excited for this, even though she was nowhere near who I was expecting to see.
Same. And we talked about, like, her voice is pretty, like, iconic, and it's kind of, she can be a little screechy. I mean, she plays into it, as I said, like, as Tammy Swanson, you hear her, like, almost do these, like, guttural, like, screams because she's crazy. I can totally hear her as Mrs. Dodds. Like, I'm actually really excited to see her do this because I think this will be a little bit of a departure from her. She's done a lot of character work, but I don't think she's done anything, like, fantastical.
Yeah.
Or, like, you know, anything quite like this. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested to see how she takes to, like, all the extra stuff, and, like, as Mrs. Dodds, I'm sure they'll have her in a rig, like, you know.
Unless, like, it's gonna be all CGI, like, I don't know how they would do that, but
I would imagine that you'll have to do some transition work and stuff, so it'll be new work for her, I think, from some of the, you know, she's done a lot of TV and stuff, so, like, I don't necessarily think she's done a lot of that. Mm-hmm. Maybe she has, and I just don't know. Who knows? But I'm really excited to see her take this on. It'll be a fun new thing for her and for the project.
Definitely. And it's kind of a smaller role, so, like, you know, she shows up a few times throughout the first season, but she doesn't pop up a whole lot, if at all, after that. I don't remember. I don't think we've seen her. We have seen her when they went to the underworld.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember, because I know when we did our a monster episode with her.
On the Furies, right?
And I remember that she doesn't really show up again after the first book, maybe one other time, I think. But they could, because she's a monster, she's going to reform in Tartarus, they can always kind of throw a Mrs. Dodds back in, you know, in later seasons if they want her back for an episode or something. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm sure they could probably figure that out. So
that would be cool.
But yeah, no, I'm excited. She'll be good.
The other person I'm really excited for is Glenn Turman as Mr. Brunner / Chiron, because he is a powerhouse of an actor. And Rick's comments read, "Not only is he a multi-talented actor, Glenn is also a champion rodeo cowboy who has run Camp Giddy Up in Southern California since 1992 to introduce inner city and at-risk youth to horsemanship at a working ranch. In other words, he is the perfect Chiron, the immortal centaur and trainer of heroes at Camp Half-Blood." I mean, really, like, you can't get much better than that. He's familiar with horses and he's used to having this mentor kind of role with children who struggle, just like a lot of the demigods struggle, and
he's a real life Kairos.
Yeah, like it's the only thing he isn't is a centaur, and who knows, maybe he is, maybe it's magic.
It's
and the
a
mist
secret.
Yeah, the mist is just covering it up.
Yeah,
but it's really hard to kind of, like, he's done so much. He has had a huge career. And a couple of the other people on here, like Jason Mantzoukas and Megan Mullally, have had huge careers. But there's just something about him that just seems really, like, legendary and iconic to me. And I have actually not really heard of him before this, but I do know that he was the mayor. I think he was like a corrupt mayor on The Wire. He was also on Murder, She Wrote, which I thought was kind of interesting, for like 4 years in various roles, which I was trying to figure out like how that works. Like, he was different people. So I don't know if they just kept bringing him back as different people or...
That was like an 70s, 80s thing. Like, even the James Bond movies used the same actor in like two different roles at one point, and it was like in one movie he played a guy and then three movies later he played another guy, and it was like, wait, that's the same actor? I think that's like a 70s thing where they were like, eh, we can reuse like, we'll just use him, we know he's
nobody will notice,
we'll just, yeah, he'll be a new guy, it'll be fine. Or they kill him off so that they know that that guy's not the guy, and then when he shows up again, Murder, She Wrote is not a supernatural show. So if he shows up again, he's somebody else.
Yeah, exactly. So, he was also in Gremlins as Roy Hansen, the bio teacher, which I made Kristen watch Gremlins for the first time, like, well, at this point, like, probably 7 or 8 years ago.
It was a while, yeah.
Yeah, but I love Gremlins, and that's cool that he was the bio teacher. Like,
yeah.
That's probably what I'm most familiar with him from.
Well, honestly, I kind of recognized his face. Like, he looks kind of familiar. Like, I don't know why. But then when I started running through his filmography yesterday, I was like, oh my gosh, he was General Waylon in Bumblebee, which I love Bumblebee. I've watched it a handful of times at this point. And so, like, as soon as I heard that he was the general, I could instantly picture him in his, like, you know, general outfit, whatever. And it just got me really excited because I was like, oh yeah, like, I remember him. He was in How to Get Away with Murder as well. He was Nate Leahy Sr., which I kind of dropped off the series, I think, before he came on.
Oh.
But I kind of know who Nate Leahy Sr. is anyway, so I'm like, oh, okay. Like, he plays the father of a character that, yeah. Anyway, but yeah, so, like, I can kind of picture him on that show, and I'm like, okay, all right. Yeah, no, I'm also very excited, not just to see him kind of take on this character that he kind of already embodies and is, but he has been around for so long and has so much experience that I think he's going to be such a wonderful resource for all these kids that are, you know, while they've all kind of done projects, they're still kind of at the beginning of their careers.
Right.
And so I think having somebody who's been around for as long as he has, it's going to have that mentee-mentor relationship.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the actors, like, it's, you know, Walker has already been in a movie with Ryan Reynolds and Mark Ruffalo and...
Jennifer Garner,
you know, so there's a ton of people that he's already gained experience from. But a TV show, you're on set together a lot longer, you know, it's a lot longer of a process, and I feel like just for all of them to just be around these people, like you said, it's going to be really cool, and I hope that they learn a lot from them, and that the older folks will impart some wisdom as much as you can to a 12-year-old. But
yeah.
I have a feeling these kids, they're very smart for their age, and I feel like they kind of know what's up, and they'll sit there and they'll listen to them. The other thing I wanted to say about Glenn Turman was that, and I mentioned this before, but it bears repeating, he had his first prominent acting role at the age of 12 as Travis Younger in the original Broadway production of Lorraine Hansberry's classic play, A Raisin in the Sun, opposite Sidney Poitier in Ruby Dee. And Sidney Poitier is, like, a huge, huge actor. I've seen a few of his movies, and they are iconic, you know, very iconic black actor. And just being 12 years old and being in that arena is crazy. And then everything that he's done since then just builds on top of that. And I just... Chiron is an immortal being, and to me, Glenn kind of embodies that in how much he's experienced. And if you just, like, his headshot that Rick put on the website just made me feel so warm and comfortable. And I cannot wait to see him in this role. It's going to be so good.
It is. And I, honestly, I think it's really funny that his first prominent role was at age 12.
Yeah,
and
right?
Stepping into the show where 12-year-olds are, their entire world is changing. And I feel like that's just, it's kismet almost. Like, it's just really cool.
I wonder how often, you know, actors like this think about how far they've come. Because sometimes it's easy to forget when your daily life is crazy and, like, you're doing, especially, like, huge actors, you know, like Ryan Reynolds, doing things left and right. Like, his career has been absolutely phenomenal. And I just wonder how often they actually sit back and go, wow, like, I've come such a long way. I've done so many things. It's kind of hard to keep track of at some point. So I think it'll be really cute to see those two opposite each other, especially Walker and Glenn.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Lastly, we have Tim Sharp as Gabe Ugliano, however you want to say it.
However you choose to pronounce it.
And Rick says, Tim had us laughing out loud with his take on Gabe Ugliano, and we can't wait to see him play stepdad to Walker Scobell's Percy Jackson. And I just love this. I love that he's already, you know, bringing the humor, which is interesting because I feel like Gabe is not necessarily meant to be funny. Like, he's meant to be the bad guy. You're meant to, like, think he's gross and not like him. So I'm really curious how that's gonna happen, you know?
I kind of have a feeling that he's gonna be so gross it's funny.
Yeah.
Like,
and I think Walker's, Percy's reaction to him will probably also be very funny.
Yeah. Like, I can kind of see them, especially it's a Disney Plus show. Mm-hmm. They're looking to, you know, direct this towards tweens and that sort of age group. I can kind of see them, like, playing up the he's so gross that it's almost hysterical.
Yeah.
Like, that kind of angle. But, yeah, no, it's, I'm excited for this, too, just to see him and Walker, because so many of these characters so far have been, like, other than Megan Mullally, I guess, Mr. D and Kyren, like, they're kind of on Percy's side. Mm-hmm. So seeing him interact with some characters that are...
Even Electo by the end, you know, she has a job to do. That's what she's doing. Like, I wouldn't necessarily call her a good guy, but, like, really, she's just trying to figure out what's going on and eventually get the helm back and everything. So.
Right, yeah. So, like, they're not in direct opposition to Percy, whereas Gabe is in direct opposition. Yeah. So, yeah, it'll be fun to see them.
There's no coming back for Gabe.
Heads. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So you've seen him on...
Yeah, I had no idea that I had seen him in anything, because Tim Sharp's face is... I feel like he can kind of fall into roles, like, he has one of those faces where you don't, unless you really recognize him, like, you, sometimes you might miss him.
Between, like, when he has his full beard and when he doesn't, to me, he looks like two different people. Like, I kind of go by facial hair when I try to recognize people, because I'm not as good with faces, and, like, he looks like two different people without the beard, so.
And I think he might have had his beard for one day at a time.
Oh, okay.
He's only in one episode, but it's the episode where the grandmother is in the hospital, and there's a nurse who keeps coming in and out and is, like, the comedic relief of this entire episode, really, because it's very serious while they're hoping that the grandmother, like, comes back and she's in, like, a coma after a stroke and all this stuff. Like, it's a very funny show, but it's a very serious episode, and then you've got this nurse who keeps coming in and, like, the daughter of the grandmother, who's the main character of the show, Penelope, is a nurse. So, like, she's constantly telling him, like, oh, do this, get this, find this. And he's just like, what are you doing? Like, she's got her own doctor. She's got her own nurse. Like, what am I doing here? Like, he's really good. So it just made me really excited, because I was like, oh, my gosh, I have seen him in stuff, because I hadn't thought I had. And I was like, okay, he's Nurse Wally. Like, that makes so much sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm honestly excited now. I do know him from something.
That's cool. He's also well known for Fun with Dick and Jane. Like, that's one of his more prominent roles. He's also done a lot of just random, like, TV things. I've actually seen him in two things. Don't tell me to, like, pick out who he was in either one of these episodes. I mean, I went back and looked, so now I remember. But he's been on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia and You're the Worst. Both of those roles I do not feel comfortable describing on this podcast, because we do try to be family friendly. The You're the Worst one is... I'll tell you later.
Oh, boy.
But he's, you know, I remember it being funny. Like, I remember it being good. I think that he's, and that's the other thing about him, is that he's very active in the improv community. So I feel like him being on set is going to keep things very lively, even though he plays, like, kind of a gross character or whatever. I think that he's going to bring a lot of that comedic energy to set, which is great, because Percy Jackson is a very funny series. So we want to keep that alive. He's also a native of Fargo, North Dakota, which I found interesting because Glenn Turman was in the show Fargo. I just thought that was a fun fact.
That is fun.
Yeah. So I think really between him and Virginia Call, like, those are the two that I am the least familiar with. And I think I'm most interested in seeing kind of, like, what they get up to in the show. And
yeah,
I think we're going to become very familiar with them very quickly, which is exciting.
We will fall in love.
Yes.
It'll be amazing.
I mean, maybe fall in love with Virginia Call. Sorry, Tim Sharp. Like, yeah. But, like, Tim Sharp, you know, we're probably not going to like your character very much. But I'm sure you're a great dude and very funny.
I appreciate your talent.
Yes, exactly. For sure. So that's it for the casting that we've gotten so far. When we get another batch, we'll probably do another episode like this where we just kind of run through them and give you guys our thoughts. But until then, you know, all of this speculation and stuff, we're just going to leave to the side until we get another announcement. And hopefully it's another, like, handful of characters that we can really dive into.
I mean, we casted 10, so whenever they want to announce the other 5, we'll take that on, too.
Exactly.
I know we're just as excited as all of you guys to get some answers to some of these other, like, important characters like Clarice and Luke and all of that. So we'll leave the speculation to the internet for now. But, yeah, when they start announcing these, we'll get excited. Don't you worry.
For sure.
All right. So now let's move on and do our chapters. That's right.
Back to chapters.
We're back to Battle of the Labyrinth.
I really miss it when we don't do it.
I did, too. I honestly, like, these are long chapters, I'll tell you right now. They're both quite long, and the second one has so much in it.
Yeah.
It's the longest recap I think I've ever written, so just stick with me.
Oh, no.
But the first one, Tyson Leads a Jailbreak, Chapter 7, has some pretty interesting stuff in it, so let's dig in. Brief recap. So when we left our heroes, they were taking a left to avoid the heavy-sounding monster that was coming from the right. Too bad the left tunnel is blocked by a huge boulder. The good news is Tyson is a big guy, and he pushes the boulder out of the way. They all team up to get it back in place before whatever is chasing them catches up. Phew. But wait, now they're in a jail cell? Annabeth quickly puts together the clues and realizes they're in Alcatraz, thanks to her having toured it on a school field trip. The worst news was still yet to come. You see, once Tyson wrenched the bars apart and stepped into the open courtyard, just in time to eavesdrop on a conversation that was going on above them, we soon find out that the convo is between Camp, a huge half-dragon, half-woman, with snakes sprouting left and right from her legs, and Briarez, a Hectonhares, the elder brother of the Cyclopes. Camp was their jailer in Tartarus before Zeus freed them, and they helped defeat the Titans in the Big War. Thanks to Tyson's superhuman hearing and creepy yet effective ability to mimic voices, they know that Camp is trying to get Briarez to serve the Master or suffer. I'm pretty sure she means Kronos. She leaves, and our heroes run to Briarez to free him, but he's having trouble seeing past his fear. Tyson wrenches open the bars, Percy cheats at rock, paper, scissors to get Briarez moving, thanks to a Paul Blofus trick, and the whole group starts to make their way back to the labyrinth entrance below. But Camp is back and pissed, so they run out to the Alcatraz courtyard. Tyson volunteers to distract her so the others can escape, since the poison her sores are spewing will hurt him, but not kill him like the others. Percy flees with the others, under protest, and they get close to the entrance. Tyson appears with Camp hot on his heels. Percy knows his Cyclops brother isn't going to make it without his help, so he takes his shield bracelet off and throws it at Camp. She gets knocked back, and Tyson has just enough time to dive into the labyrinth with Percy right behind. And they escape. Yes!
Wow. That was a good blow-by-blow, though.
Yeah, pretty much. Not as much goes on in this episode, but what happens is, like, substantial.
it's pretty important. I think, first of all, Camp is pretty cool, and that's definitely not how I thought you pronounced her name until I looked it up. I was like, Campy.
I was really glad you put the pronunciation in here, because I would have said, like, Campe or Campy, because that E makes you want to say
something. Right, yeah, but apparently it's Camp, according to the internet, so, you know, as always, blanket statement of apologies for mispronunciation of anything.
Yes.
But she's pretty interesting, because she's, like, a she-dragon, and she's older than most of the other monsters. Like, she's one of the oldest monsters they've seen so far. And that, to me, is so interesting, because with that comes a lot more mystery and a lot more power. And for, like, somebody like Percy to go up against somebody like that is kind of intense and scary.
Well, I loved how you got a sense of her age and power. I think it was Grover who was like, she smells different. Like, there's just, like, you can almost feel this old, ancient monster energy just, like, radiating off of her. And so she's so much more intimidating than some of these other monsters that die and come back so quickly. Like, she's been around for so long that, yeah, she just seeps this evil, oozing monster energy. We learn a lot about the history of kind of Cyclopes and the hundred-handed ones. I'm not saying that word again. I do remember. But yeah, like, we get a lot of the history of what's happened, and, like, we learn about Briares and how the hundred-handed ones, like, their role in the world and how they used to be huge giants, and it's all very cool. Mm-hmm. It's hard to kind of place why we are meeting these characters right now. Like, obviously they're in the labyrinth and it's just one of those things.
Right.
But we really have no idea what role Camp or Briares is going to play in the future right now. So it's just kind of like, okay, big adventure. They save Briares. Like, this mm-hmm. is good, but we need to keep moving. So
it feels like definitely just a setup to, you know, Briares, like, helping them later on, basically, and kind of explaining a little bit more of the whole idea behind immortality and all of that kind of stuff. But I really like that Tyson kind of thought the world of him the whole time and then was kind of disappointed at the end, like, don't meet your heroes kind of thing. But yeah. Tyson is such a pure soul that he really just didn't understand why this person, this being that he looked up to, wasn't quite what he had expected. But there's so much history between the hundred-handed ones, the Cyclops, and, like, Camp and the gods and the whole Titan War and all of that, that you can tell that this is mythology for Tyson as a Cyclops. Like, it's his history that he's coming up face to face with, and that is so interesting. And something that I don't think the demigods really understand the weight of it until, like, I don't remember if it was Annabeth, maybe Percy didn't really understand, like, how big of a deal it was until maybe even Tyson was the one who kind of explained what was going on and why it was so important to him.
Yeah. Speaking of Tyson, something else in this chapter that just kind of stuck out to me and I wanted to hit on it is when they're you know, running from this beast, scary woman, and Tyson is the only one who can really do anything about it. Percy has to kind of, like, trust that Tyson is gonna come back to him because he's had to let him go and fight things before, and it didn't end, you know, it ended fine, but it didn't feel like it ended fine for Percy. He had to, you know, he thought Tyson was dead, he thought he was gone. So, like, I really loved that in this whole chase scene, you get this moment between Tyson and Percy where Tyson's like, it'll hurt me, it won't kill me, you have to go. Mm-hmm. And Percy goes. Like, he doesn't love the idea, but he trusts Tyson and trusts Tyson's judgment and goes. And here comes Tyson barreling toward him, you know, looking for some help. And Percy's there to help him when he needs it. But, like, I just really loved that Percy does have that trust in Tyson now. Like, their relationship really has progressed that far, and it just made me really happy.
Yeah. I, you're right. Their relationship has progressed a lot, and every time we get another hint of that, just makes me really happy.
Mm-hmm. The last note I have for this chapter, because it really was just a big action sequence, which will be amazing in the show when we get it.
That's true.
Was Paul Blowfist giving Percy the edge against Briares with the rock paper scissors gun?
Yeah,
finger guns, which I thought was hilarious, and it shows up in the next chapter too. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so good fun. I love a Paul Blowfist mention. It does give me great joy. So, yeah. That pretty much wraps up this chapter, because it really was just getting into the history and you know, the action of the sequence. So we'll get into our favorite quotes. Karen, do you want to do yours first?
Yes. This was kind of the Percy's narration, and he says, "As we sprinted for the cell blocks, the last thing I saw was Tyson picking up a Dippin' Dots stand and throwing it at Camp. Ice cream and poison exploded everywhere, all the little snakes in Camp's hair dotted with Tutti Frutti." And, like, I love Dippin' Dots. Like, Dippin' Dots are a childhood nostalgia thing for me, and I just think it's hilarious that Dippin' Dots were mentioned here, but also that camp is just covered in the ice cream of the future.
I was going to say, for anyone who doesn't know, Dippin' Dots are the ice cream of the future.
Yeah.
These little teeny ice cream dots, balls, yeah. things that you, yeah. I never actually ate it.
You've never eaten Dippin' Dots?
No. Like, they had it at Cedar Point and all that stuff growing up. Like, I know what Dippin' Dots is, but I've never actually had
Dippin' wonder Dots. If you would like it, because it's kind of a weird texture thing. Like,
they use, like,
they freeze dry it.
Yeah.
And but, so like, it's weird to just eat, like, this scoop of, like, bald ice cream, but it's fun. But I could see why some people wouldn't like it. We actually just saw some of it at the Indianapolis Zoo when we went. Nice. And I was like, oh, Dippin' Dots, but I didn't end up getting any. They've always been very expensive. Like, that's part of the problem. But, you know, ice cream of the future, like, it's going to cost you some money.
Right? You're in the future.
Yeah.
I also have to say, with your quote, I also love the moment right after that with the sunglasses. Like,
yeah.
From the merch stand. Like, the little snakes put the sunglasses on, and I'm just like, it's one of those Rick Riordan details that I'm like, yes. Like, it just adds some joy to the moment
terror. He's so good at, juxtaposing, like, something that's legitimately terrifying with, like, just a little bit of fun. Funny to make it a little less scary.
One or two details just to kind of take the edge off the scary. Okay, and mine was, camp's too big to get through the doors, I said hopefully. Then the wall exploded.
Yeah.
It's just one of those Percy moments where he's like, oh, this is the answer. That is not the answer. Love Percy. Okay, and then our favorite moments. Mine was Percy trusting Tyson, but then being there with the assist when Tyson needed it the most. I really liked that part of this chapter for them. And what was yours?
Mine was Percy tricking Briarys with the gun in rock, paper, scissors, because I feel like it's a very, like, middle schooler thing to do, like, it was actually the perfect way to get him to move, too, so Percy's a genius.
See, our way of cheating was not a finger gun, it was dynamite.
Oh.
Like, we had rock, paper, scissors, dynamite.
Okay.
And you only...
And you just hold up one finger?
Right? This is a stick of dynamite. I don't remember how it works, but I remember us joking around about dynamite. Hi, Kelly.
Hi.
She wants cuddles. Soon. Yeah. Okay. So now we will move on to chapter 8, which I am already apologizing for the longest recap in the history of recaps, but here we go. Chapter 8 is entitled, We Visit the Demon Dude Ranch. After moving far enough away from Alcatraz, they soon come to a room with a giant black pit. Briarys mentions that it goes straight to Tartarus. He thinks the group would be better off without him. Everyone takes a turn trying to convince him that he can still be helpful to them, but he ultimately runs off into the dark. Tyson is sad about it, but they have to keep moving. Annabeth doesn't want to camp near this pit, so they keep moving onward until they find a homier spot, where the walls are made of marble blocks and bronze torch holders are fastened to the walls. Everyone takes a chance to rest, some easier than others, but when Percy can't sleep, he goes to sit watch with Annabeth. She mentions that she wishes navigating the labyrinth was more logical. She's frustrated that all her studying isn't paying off like she wants it to. Percy reminds her that they never know what they're doing, and it always turns out okay. Annabeth then takes her shift sleeping, and when Percy finally gets a chance, he dreams of Daedalus and Icarus. Daedalus is much older now and has built him and his son wings of bronze to escape their labyrinth prison. He warns his son for, like, the millionth time that they have to fly at a safe distance from both the sun and the sea. Minos bursts in to surprise them, but he's too late. Father and son use a burst of hot air from a covered manhole to push them into the sky. Icarus quickly forgets his dad's warnings, and his wings disintegrate, leaving him flightless and plunging towards the ocean, which is when Percy wakes up. He keeps his dream a secret. They all eat breakfast, granola bars and juice boxes, and keep on moving. They soon find themselves under a steel grate that Grover explains is a cattle guard to keep cows from running out the ranch gates at, like, a dude ranch. Tyson pops it off its hinges and they all pile out. A two-headed dog, Orthus, comes bounding out of the underbrush, followed by a huge gray-haired cowboy that looks like a jacked Father Time. Eurytion.
I mean, you're not wrong, but it still made me laugh.
That's how he's described in the book. I took it right from the book. The cowboy tells them to go back into the labyrinth and get away, but Percy insists that they meet the other demigod that Eurytion mentioned came through right before them. He takes them to meet the boss, Mr. Jirion, the owner of Triple G Ranch. Nico appears a minute or two later and is ready to take Percy down, but that's not in the books. Jirion ushers them all onto a cow-themed mini-train and shows them the ranch. The end of the tour is a large stable half-filled with poop that the flesh-eating horses are traipsing around in. Blech. It's clear to Annabeth that Jirion is a monster and is working for Kronos, even if the rancher insists he'll work for whomever's paying. Nico tires of all this delay and insists Jirion make the deal Nico came to barter for. It is then that Jirion reveals that Luke is paying for demigods, and Nico will make an extra special gift. He also mentions that he's been paid well to give the questers safe passage, so he'll let them go. Which is interesting. Anywho, in order to save Nico, Percy thinks quickly and offers to clean the stables in exchange for all of their freedom, including Nico. Jirion gives Percy till sunset to complete the task, and then starts the Moomobile back toward the house, leaving Percy to figure out how the heck he's gonna get this done.
Alright, so, yeah, that was a lot.
That was a lot.
I'm sorry right now if I pronounced any of those names wrong. It's hard, okay? They're all hard. Especially because they look one way, and then sometimes they are another, whatever. I'm not gonna worry about it. Again, blanket pronunciation apology.
Yeah. we should just put that at the top of every
really
episode.
Hard.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, so let's dive in because there's a lot of stuff in here and so just a lot.
Yeah. Anyway. I actually really loved this chapter a lot. Like, it was fascinating, but there was just so much.
And it's also kind of a bridge chapter. Like, yeah. We're basically moving from one giant action piece to the next major problem. And so you have all these little things that happen in between, and you got to get them all in there, but it just makes for a really big chapter full of stuff. So, yeah. We should probably start with the Briaras stuff, because that basically is where we start this chapter, is, you know, them kind of moving into the next room, which is the pit, and Briaras kind of talking about how he should just throw himself to Tartarus because it'd be better for everybody. And they kind of try to talk him out of it and say, like, no, you can be helpful, and he's not really hearing it. But the thing that I think is most important about this is just the discussion they have about how non-monsters, like other immortal beings, fade. Mm-hmm. And they make a point to talk about how, you know, Briar's brothers, the other hundred-handed ones, have faded and are gone, and they kind of mention that Medusa's sisters have also gone by the wayside, and she mentions that they leave her behind.
Right.
And they all kind of relate it to them being forgotten, but Percy makes a point to say, like, maybe it's you who stopped believing in yourself, and that's when you guys fade, is when you stop mm-hmm. believing in, you know, your importance to the world. And I just think that's such a cool idea.
Yeah.
Especially for a middle grade book.
Yeah. I really like the idea that it's kind of both, because they do get forgotten and then lose their will to stay immortal. And we see that a lot. First of all, we see that in the next series, the Heroes of Olympus series, between the Greek and Roman. Like, that's kind of, that idea is tied up into why they're shifting back and forth and those sort of things. And you see that in, I think, like American Gods and a lot of other ones that play on this idea of mythology and multiple gods and stuff. And the idea that if you get forgotten, you cease to exist and you cease to have power, which is so interesting. And I think in American Gods, I've never actually read it, the newer gods, the technological gods kind of come up in power and beat out some of the older gods that aren't as important to people anymore. And I really love that. And it's really sad too, like, to be immortal, but also, like, kind of to die at the same time. And that must be really difficult if you've been around for thousands and thousands of years, especially if you're like a god like Zeus or something, who's full of himself and, you know, thinks he's the best. And for him to start fading, I would imagine would be like a shock to the system. No pun intended.
I think that's also, you know, when you think of the big ancient gods, like Gaia always gives me a bit of that, like, she's so ancient and old and has so much power that, like, imagining a god like that kind of dissolving and, mm-hmm. and ceasing to be would be so, like, it would change everything, you know? And so, yeah, just thinking of the implications of mm-hmm. these immortal creatures losing the ability to believe in themselves once people forget them and just kind of fading off. It's, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was a bit of a heavy part of this chapter, but really important and really interesting to think about. Okay, so the next major thing, everybody goes to bed, and Percy and Annabeth have a little chat, and I like the check-in here more than anything they actually talk about. I like that we get a moment where Percy and Annabeth have a chance to be alone, kind of, and just have a chat and reconnect, and, you know, she has a moment to kind of say, like, this isn't what I thought it was going to be, and I'm having trouble, and I need your, you know, I need you to help as much as you can, but I know this isn't your forte either.
Yeah. I really appreciate that from Annabeth because she doesn't ask for help very easily. And if you look at her back in the first book, like, she is not open to anybody. And for her to admit that she's struggling to Percy, I think means a lot. And for him to be like, hey, I know you didn't tell me the whole prophecy. Like, you want to tell me what it is? And he doesn't call her out or, like, make her feel bad about it. He's just like, you know, tell me what it is. Let me try to help you. And she's kind of like, I can't. Like, she's so scared and she just isn't ready to do it. And he doesn't push her. I think it's just a really healthy friendship that they have right here.
Yeah. And then he goes on to ask about this big decision and she's like, Percy, I can't. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. So I think it might all be wrapped up. I mean, my brain doesn't entirely remember every detail of this whole, you know, crazy thing. But, you know, if they're related at all, I can kind of see why she's like, I have to figure this out. I want to do it myself. Like, yeah. And he, again, he doesn't push. He kind of offers, steps up, and then just says, you know, I'm here. And basically then lets her go to sleep, and he eventually gets some sleep. And when he gets some sleep, he has this vision, this prophecy.
Prophecy count number 19.
And he gets to see Daedalus and Icarus, and basically it's the story of Icarus,
yeah,
which is a pretty well-known story of the wings melting when he flies too close to the sun. Mm-hmm. I did think it was interesting, the water aspect of it, because I don't think I've ever realized that there was a danger of flying too low, too, and Icarus doesn't really pay attention to either warning from his father.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a tragic story. And
these wings were made out of metal, which I don't think is true to the original tale. I thought they were actual, like,
feathers.
Yeah.
It might be. I don't remember. It makes sense for Daedalus that it would be bronze.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. It might have been actual feathers in the literal Greek, the actual myth, like, the actual story.
I've always really liked the tale of Icarus. I think that it's very visual, and I just like that, you know, it's included. Of course it's included in this because of the maze and everything like that, so it does make sense, but yeah, I really liked seeing this. This is me trying to waste time. Yes, they were made of feathers.
Oh, good.
I was like, they don't know that I'm Googling this right now. I did not make it. I kind of made it obvious, but
I didn't help.
No, that's okay. Yeah, I think they were actually feathers. So yeah. Just the fact that they were metal, I think, is just kind of cool, and, like, would love to see that in the TV show.
Right? Just add it to
the more list. Like a steampunk vibe.
Right? I can definitely get steampunk vibe from the bronze and the, yeah. It's a pretty straightforward interpretation of it. The only thing that's really different is the bronze feathers. But, yeah, Minos is too late, and we see it all happen. It ending with Icarus falling and Percy, like, kind of experiencing that fall, even though he's actually watching it from a third person kind of perspective. He then is also falling with Icarus, so it's like that's what jars him awake, and he realizes that it was a quote-unquote dream slash prophecy. So moving on from that, the next thing that happens is they find this grate above them in the floor, and Grover explains to them that it's a cattle grate, and, you know, it's terrible for animals with hooves to walk on it. It's hard. Mm-hmm. So that keeps the cattle in line, which takes us to the Triple G Ranch.
Which I loved. I mean, and that's the thing, like, it's not the best place. Like,
no.
So basically, there are all sorts of animals, including the red cows, which are sacred to Apollo, but they keep all sorts of other creatures there for various clients. And sometimes people just want to own those animals, sometimes they want to eat them. Like, there's, you know, different, like, he was literally selling the meat of the sacred red cows of Apollo, and Apollo either doesn't know or doesn't care, probably doesn't know.
Yeah.
And so he's, you know, Geryon is kind of getting away with it. So the ranch isn't really a good place, and the demigods are fairly upset about what's going on, but there's really nothing they can do. But for some reason, I really liked the idea of it. I think having all of those creatures in one place is really interesting. I think Eurytion, I'm so sorry, I don't know how to pronounce his name. He's a son of Ares, and he's the one with the two-headed dog, which again, cool, Orthus. Yeah. He seemed like a fairly good guy. Like, he seemed okay, and I kind of liked him, even though he was doing Jirion's bidding.
His first instinct was to tell them to go.
Yeah, he actually told them, like, you know, you should leave now, and if you choose not to, I gotta take you to the boss, and it's probably not gonna be good for you. Right. So, he seemed like a good dude.
Yeah.
But the ranch is just cool. I just like the idea of it.
No, I hear you. It's definitely not a good place.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the worst place they could be or have been either. So it's kind of falls into that middle ground.
Yeah.
I did like seeing some new creatures, some familiar creatures. Like, Annabeth gets really excited about, it's a hybrid creature, and I do not remember what it's made of. Half a chicken, I believe. But, like, she gets really excited about them because she thought they were extinct and gone forever. They're an ancient Greek creature. And then, what we hear mention of the scorpions at 1.2, and that kind of propels Percy to remember seeing the scorpions at camp and all that, and all, you know, how all that entails with Quintus, and we'll get to that later.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's not a great place, but not a bad place necessarily entirely. But yeah, it's definitely going to present some trouble for them. That's for sure.
Yeah. And Jirion is not like a good person. Also, I had so much trouble trying to visualize him because he has one head and three chests.
Okay? But two arms and four armpits.
Yeah.
Percy.
It was... so, like, basically his middle torso is connected through, like, a shoulder joint to the next two torsos, and they have arms. I Googled it and, like... I wish you could see my face right now because it was strange.
I did not Google it. I just accepted that I would never understand it until we get it in the show. I was like, well, this will be an interesting character to see that.
It will be. Yeah. I mean, we've seen things with multiple heads. We've seen things with multiple arms and all that kind of thing. But like multiple chests and one head.
Yeah.
Like I think I've seen like multiple heads and multiple chests. But I don't, like, in a cartoon, I don't remember what it was. But I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like this before.
I don't think anyone has. But yeah, Jirion is basically a mercenary. He's willing to sell and raise whatever people want. He just wants to make money, and he's selfish. And he's a monster, and Annabeth calls him a monster. And I think she's being more, like... talking about like he's a monster of a person, and he goes, what gave it away? Like, he's an actual monster, not just a monster like Annabeth is talking about. So I kind of loved that play on words,
because it goes to show you that Annabeth doesn't really see people like that as monsters necessarily, like, you know.
Yeah.
Whatever. Like, she's come a long way with Tyson as a Cyclops and that sort of thing, and he's a very good person. Mm-hmm. So when she calls him a monster, she means you're a bad person.
Yeah, like a truly bad person.
Yeah.
So they meet Jirion, and who's also has Nico.
Yeah, that
Nico makes an appearance.
That was kind of surprising, and I didn't remember... I thought maybe he would show up here because Percy just talked about how he was, like, in the underworld. They were getting close to him. They found the cheeseburger wrappers and everything. And basically, first of all, Percy basically says, like, he was too young to look so angry, which that line really stuck out to me because that's so sad and such a difference from the Nico we met at the beginning of Titan's Curse. But then Nico thinks Percy is there to kill him.
Yeah.
Why?
That got me, too. Because, like, Percy thinks that Nico's trying to kill him. Percy believes that Nico wants to kill him. He thinks he's the soul that Nico wants to trade for Bianca's.
Mm-hmm.
And then Nico thinks that Percy and them are there to kill him. And it took me a minute, and I was like, maybe he thinks it's because he threatened Percy and, like, brought all the scary stuff before he disappeared into the labyrinth at the end of the last book. Maybe he thinks they're there to kill him for that, because I can't think of any other reason.
The only other reason I could think of is just Minos is in his head, and he's like, you gotta kill him before he kills you, or something like that.
So Nico firmly believes that they're there to kill him, and Percy's like, no. And Nico's like, well, I don't want to kill you. I don't want your soul. Like, your soul is nothing.
Yeah. Bianca's worth, like, 10 of you or something.
Right. So he's pissed. But, yeah. So it's nice to see Nico, but he's not the Nico we know.
Mm-hmm.
He's definitely going through some stuff.
But now they're together, and I think that, like, moving forward, you know, we can wrap up the issues that they have and kind of get to the Nico we all know and love.
Yes. Okay, so Jirian takes them all on a tour of this ranch, and they see all these creatures, and they talk about all the things that Jirian's doing and who he's selling to and all of that. But it ultimately gets us to these stables full of horses and horse poop.
Yeah.
This is the poop episode.
Yeah.
Thanks, Rick.
That'll be the title.
I love saying poop.
The poop episode.
I mean, great, yeah. But this stable is full of poop because Jirian never cleans it, and these horses are flesh-eating horses, so I can understand why nobody cleans it.
Like, right.
It's not great, but I can understand. And as they're standing here talking about these creatures, Nico has finally had it and is like, I want my deal. I'm here to make a deal. Let's do this. I don't want to wait any longer. And in that moment, Jirian says, like, well, you're going to get your deal, but it's not the deal you were here for. You are actually valuable trading fodder, and I want the payday. So I'm going to turn you into Luke, which when he finds out who you actually are,
mm-hmm.
is going to be an even bigger payday than he thinks.
Right.
And, like, yeah, so all of this is happening, and Percy's saying, like, no, we can't let him trade Nico. And we learn in this moment that Jirian has been paid to let our questers mm-hmm. go, all four of them. Who paid him? Do you remember? Because I honestly
no.
do not remember.
So my first instinct, weirdly enough, was Quintus.
See, mine was Hera.
Ooh, Hera. That makes so much more sense.
I honestly don't remember who paid,
yeah.
but just because they just saw her and she mentioned the ranch and Percy says, like, oh, yeah, she mentioned the ranch. My first instinct was that Hera.
Your reason has a lot more logical basis than mine does.
But
so
I want to hear yours. Why do you think it's Quintus?
I don't know. I just, because clearly Quintus, so we saw the Triple G ranch boxes that the scorpions came out of. So we know Quintus has ties to the ranch. And then there's the funny quote about, you know, I won't ruin it because it's your favorite. But basically, Jirian does know who Quintus is. So there's a connection there. And I just, like, Quintus hasn't served his purpose yet in the story, so I was like, maybe there's something there where he's, like, working both sides, or, like, for some reason Kronos needs Percy to get to wherever he's going, or, like, Luke wants them to discover the center of the maze and get Ariadne's string so that they can steal it from him. So, like, they need to have safe passage in order to do that.
I think those are all perfectly valid,
yeah.
Because we don't know who paid. And mm-hmm. my first instinct was Hera, just because she was kind of on the top of my brain.
Yeah.
But, like, it could have been any of those, honestly.
I think it makes a lot of sense for it to be her, too.
Yeah. So, hopefully we'll find out. I assume we'll find out.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody paid. So, Jirian is ready to let them go as soon as this Nico deal is taken care of. Which, first of all, if Luke finds out that he's got the other four, unless Luke's the one paying, I can't
right.
imagine he would want them
yeah.
to be let go. But whatever. Jirian has made his deals, and he's apparently going to stick to them. But Percy gets this idea that, no, we're not letting him trade Nico. We'll make a deal for him. And out of nowhere, in pure Percy fashion, he says, let's make a deal. And he proposes that he will clean the stables if he can get all of this poop gone, that Jirian will let them all go, including Nico. And Jirian agrees, but gives him till sunset to do it. And so Percy has this ginormous task in front of him, and everyone's leaving, and that's where we leave the chapter.
Yeah. This reminded me, and I Googled it just to make sure, this is a fifth labor of Hercules, as he had to clean out one of the king's stables and
okay.
everything. So it kind of reminded me of that. Also, with the river being right there, I'm thinking Percy's going to be okay. But also, is all that poop going into the river? Because, like, I'm kind of worried about it.
Well, for some reason, I do remember this task. Like, I remember Percy cleaning the stables. Not, like, details about it, but I remember the general event. And so now I was really excited. And then the chapter ended, and I was like, no, I want to keep going. So I did not read ahead, and I will probably go read this chapter right away.
Oh, yeah.
I do want to know what's going on. But yeah, that's where we leave things. So we don't see the resolution of it yet, but we know that Percy's about to go try and clean this stable, and the others are being taken back to the ranch big house, and we will hopefully see them soon.
Yeah.
Okay, that was a lot. Again, a lot happened in this chapter, but I think it's getting us to Percy cleaning these stables so that we can move on and back into the labyrinth.
Right, and Percy and Nico can be together, and then they all do their thing.
Exactly. Agreed. Okay, so my favorite quote, Karen kind of already mentioned it, so I'll do mine first. It's a little bit of an interaction between Jirion and Percy, and Jirion says, "Quintus, short gray hair, muscular swordsman?" Percy says, "Yeah," and Jirion goes, "Never heard of him." So, yeah, you clearly can tell that Quintus has spent some time at Triple G, or at least has connections.
Yeah, or he's a client, he's ordered from there before, and
Jirion is familiar, but not going to give any clues away.
Yeah.
What was yours?
Mine was one of Percy's narrations about Jirion, and he says, "I figured this was how he tortured people. He embarrassed them to death riding around in the Moomobile."
I did love the Moomobile.
Yeah.
It's good fun, it's good fun. And so vivid to think of one of those little kiddie trains with cows all over it. Like, you can definitely see it in your mind. Okay, and then our favorite moments. Mine was generally seeing Nico again, even if he wanted to kill Percy. It provided Percy with more info. We learn in this chapter that Nico doesn't want to kill him, but he's still looking for the right soul to trade for Bianca. And Nico thinks they're looking for him to kill him, and it's a whole mess. And then Percy also learns that Minos is the ghost that Nico's been hanging out with, it's all important. Mm-hmm. So, like, while this isn't a great interaction between Nico and Percy, it's chock full of growth and them kind of letting each other in on what they're doing, even though they're not telling
each
other stuff.
A lot of information exchange, just because we knew King Minos was the ghost, but like, now it's finally confirmed, you know, this far through the book. Although I guess we're only on 7 and 8, so it's I feel like we've been reading this book forever because we've skipped a couple of weeks, but we're really not that far into it. I think we're like a third of the way through, so.
But yeah, lots learned, and I think that's more or less what I was excited about. Plus, having Nico back is kind of
right. Yeah.
Fun. What was yours?
Mine was just the whole ranch. I just think it's a really cool visual. I know that it's not great, and I do not support the mistreatment of any of these animals, and they should not be eating the sacred cows of Apollo.
Absolutely.
But just in terms of visuals and like another big, I have the show on my brain. So another big set within the world of Percy Jackson, like this thing existing here, is really cool, and it kind of fills things out a bit more for me.
Yeah, absolutely. So that pretty much wraps up our chapters. So next week we will be reading chapters 9 and 10. So make sure to get those read and be ready for the discussion. And make sure to reach out to us, as always. We love hearing from you guys. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at SubjectifyMedia.com. We are home to 3 other podcasts, including Rewatchable, where we rewatch canceled and cult classic shows, Not About the Weather, which is a general interest show that sometimes features interviews with creators, and Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, which was recently revived thanks to the upcoming Teen Wolf movie. Contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast, or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. And we've been more active on Instagram lately. So
we have been.
We'll keep an eye out for you if you reach out there.
Yeah.
You can also email us your long-form thoughts to prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. We hope you consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5 stars really help others to find us, so that would be a big help. You can leave us questions and comments in any of these places, plus ideas for content or episodes you might want to hear us talk about. We love interacting with all of you guys, so we really, really appreciate it when we hear from you. So that would be great. Next week, we're going to do a monster guide, and we're going to dive into Hellhounds, which is pretty apropos considering Mrs. O'Leary and all of that. So
we're gonna
look into them and see their place in Greek myth as well as in the Riordan universe and see all about them.
Yeah.
I'm excited.
Me too.
I do love Mrs.
Puppies.
O'Leary. Okay, so until then, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio signing off. Over and out.